Welcome to Stoma for Life, the Bowel Cancer Awareness and Life as an Ostomate radio show and podcast. Your host, Rafaela, is here to debunk myths, clear up misconceptions, and help you approach the subject that so many people are afraid to talk about in a positive manner. Listen in for a new perspective. Stoma for Life on UK Health Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Stoma for Life here on UK Health Radio. This is part two of Faye Louise's incredible story of having been diagnosed with appendix cancer after she went in for a cyst operation. Now, Faye, I'm truly amazed at what has happened to you and how you've actually gone through the mother of all operations. This surgery was absolutely tremendous. And we are going to carry on talking about this. This is part two of your journey.
Is this my last night on earth? You know, is this my last night I'm going to see light or I'm going to see life? Because I just didn't know. And my operation was at 7:30 a.m. on the Wednesday, the 1st of November, 2023. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really weird. They got me up at 5:30 in the morning and bought me the gown. Mm-hmm. And the surgical socks, obviously, mm-hmm. for prevent DVT and everything like that, blood clotting, put it on the bed and said, we'd like you to have a shower, wash your hair, you know, but don't wash anything, like, don't use soap, don't use any shower gel or anything, and don't shave. Pubic area, they'll sort it all out in the theatre, mm-hmm. legs, anything like that, don't shave, because if you have any sort of cut from shaving, we mm-hmm. can't do the surgery because of risk of infection. Yeah. I was like, okay. So, yeah, I was standing in the shower and I just put the gown on and the socks and looked down and just thought, like, okay, this is it. This is the day that the eviction began, if you like. That's what I called it. I had, like, a little gratitude book and I actually wrote something on the morning, like, this is it now, cancer. It's me and you. You know, I've got my armour set and a great team of warriors, like, army behind me. My partner came very early in the morning, obviously, to walk to me with theatre. And I remember going out the door, walking down the corridor, doing the turning a little bit of a corner and seeing the word, like, theatre. And I was just like, I can't do this. And he was like, no, you can, you have to, like, you have no choice, go on. Yeah. And I was like, I can't. And then I got to the point where they said to him, you have to, this is the furthest you can go now with her. Mm-hmm. We have to take her in now. And I remember standing there looking at him and I said to him, like, sorry. I just said to him, like, please look after Neville, the dog. And your mum has all the Christmas presents.
My God.
Because I didn't know if I was coming out.
Yeah.
And he just said to me, don't be silly. I'll see you tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Or the next day. And I said, but we don't know that. So, you know, just look after Neville. Your mum has the presents. So you've got something from me at Christmas at least.
Yeah.
And with that, I went through the doors. I went into the room where they were going to put me to sleep. Mm-hmm. I had this teddy that Will had got me, actually, like a little medical teddy bear with a bandage on his arm, which is in some of my pictures that the media have used. And I said to the nurse, can you keep the teddy with me? Because it's like, well, my partner's got me. It's like a comfort thing for me. I just want the teddy with me. And she said, yeah, we'll look after teddy. We'll keep the teddy there. And I don't remember anything else. They're very crafty. I'm telling you that right now.
Yeah.
Because at Red Hill, when they put me to sleep, they were like, right, you're going to feel like you're drunk and we're about to fall into a bush. That was how mm-hmm. the woman, like, described it. Like, we're going to get drunk together and you're going to fall in the bush. Mm-hmm. And then that's it. Then you'll wake up.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just remember them saying to me, who got you the teddy then? Oh, what about your dog? And that's it. I don't remember anything. Or I remember saying, yeah, Neville, and that's it.
Okay.
I do not remember anything else at all. They so craftily put me to sleep. But I think it's because I was so anxious, shaking, on edge, upset, that I think if they would have told me they're about to administer it, it probably would have made me a lot worse. So I'm thankful that they didn't tell me. But it's quite scary that someone can just put this stuff in you and boom, you're gone.
Yeah.
So, that was on the Wednesday. The operation, my partner had a call halfway through the operation where the consultant just said it's going well so far. However, we do need to do a bowel resection because there is some cells like in the small bowel. So I think Will said, "Oh my God, like is she going to end up with a stoma when she wakes up?" And they said, "No, we don't think so, but we'll know for sure once we've we go in there." And he said, "Okay, well you've got to do what you've got to do, haven't you? She's asleep, and it's she's done 6 hours so far." And yeah, and then they phoned in when they'd finished the operation. So I went in at 7:30 a.m. and I believe he got a call about 6 p.m. to say that I was in ICU, which was another scary thought for me before the op. Why do I have to go to ICU? That's where you go when they think you're going to die. That's where you go when they think you're not going to make it, or that's where you go when you're on life support. It's all these scary thoughts. And they actually kept me asleep until Thursday evening at 6 o'clock. So I got out of surgery Wednesday at 6 p.m. and I didn't get woken up till about I think 5:45 in the evening on Thursday. They kept me asleep all that time so my body could rest and keep an eye on me because of such a major surgery. I mean, it's the biggest operation one can have in their lifetime, really. It's mother of all surgery, and it's a massive hit on the body.
Absolutely. And you, I mean, you mentioned all the organs that they took. So in total, I counted, I think, eight.
Yeah, eight, and they scraped my pelvis, they scraped all my diaphragm, they took a little bit of the liver. I dread to think what it's like inside there, to be honest, if I could have a little peek inside my stomach. But yeah, I remember waking up in ICU. Everything was very blurry, like you just get like a silhouette of a man at the beginning of Bond. That's what it looked like when everyone was walking towards me, like these silhouettes of dark people, like darkness. And I remember looking at the clock and seeing, quite ironically, 6 o'clock again, because it was 6 o'clock when I was in Redhill and I woke up from the laparotomy and saw the clock. It was 6 o'clock. And the nurse rushed straight over to me. And then my consultant was at the side of the bed and he said, "Hello, Faye, do you remember me?" And I looked up and I was just like, "Oh, Alex." And I had to touch his arm, like, to see, like, to actually know I wasn't dreaming and that I was alive, that I was actually there. And I just said to him, "I'm alive." And he said, "Yep, yeah, operation went really well. Excellent, in fact. You told me that your one wish for Christmas was to be cancer free. And I can give you that wish. We've got it all."
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a too good to be true moment. I had to ask him, like, really? You got it all, really? And then he left, and then my partner was there, which I didn't see him until after Alex had left. He turned up and he said, have they told you like the good news?" And I was like, and he was like, "They've got it all." And he was like, "They've got it all." I was like, "Yeah, they told me that they got it all. Really, they got it all." It was just, like when you're diagnosed, you feel as if that is a thing that's too good to be true, because immediately you just think cancer kills. That's exactly how you think, and it's how you feel, and you can't help it. Mentally, it plays so many tricks on you. Yeah, I those are words that I just never thought that I would hear. We've got it all. The cancer's gone. But I'm not going to become too complacent, because with the type of cancer I've got, the pseudomyxoma peritonei, PMP, for those that obviously it's a bit of a mouthful for some to say, I'm on scans for up to 20 years. So I'm not going to let my guard down just yet, if you like, because again, going back to how my mum was, she had a full hysterectomy. They told her cancer had gone. And a year and a half later, with a scan, she had it worse than ever. But again, that's different cancer, bowel cancer. My mum had colorectal cancer as well. So, yeah, it's a completely different type of outcome for pseudomyxoma. It's what I need to try and remember, but it's hard trying to convince yourself of that, really.
And look, it's still early days. I mean, we're talking about what, three, just over 3 months ago.
It'll be 14 weeks Wednesday coming, yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean, you've got to give yourself time to adjust to that thought, first of all, come to terms with what has happened, what you've gone undergone. I'm sure, the more distance is between the actual surgery and, the recovery time, I think things will get easier. Okay, you've got 20 years now where you said you're going to be on their check, on the checklist or on their radar. For somebody that's also had a cancer diagnosis, to me, I'm sort of also looking forward to them checking it to make sure that there is nothing there, because I know there is nothing there, but it's just sort of an added validation. Oh, yes, there is nothing there.
I think that's what it is. I'm just searching for reassurance. I mean, I'm worried about November scan, and it's only like February. But I think because for me, November scan will be like the monumental scan, where it will be the first scan after the op. That will be the scan that tells me, fingers crossed, touch wood and everything, that it's Ned, still no evidence of disease. And I think once I've had that first scan that will tell me that a year later I'm okay still, I think that's when I might start to settle down a little bit. And obviously, going back to work is pending in March. So that would be a massive distraction for me as well, and feel that my life is sort of back to what we call the new normal. You know, when you're in the cancer diagnosis world, or you've had cancer or been treated from cancer, it's never the, your life is never the same again. And that's the sad reality of it. You're always tarnished by the cancer in some way. So yeah, just getting back to work, I think will make me feel like that little bit of part of me that was there before has come back. But yeah, it's just about getting used to the new normal, my new body, new image as well, because obviously during my operation I lost 10 kilos in weight.
Wow, that's massive.
Yeah, I was 64.5 kilos when I went in for the surgery, and I came out at 53.4.
My gosh, and you're a tall woman, I mean, that's really,
I've always been slim. You know, I've never been, which is why with the whole cancer being there, so they nickname it jelly belly, because some survivors I've spoke to, they've actually gone undiagnosed till the 10-year mark, and that's when they get what they call jelly belly, where you look like you're about to drop a baby.
Oh my
And
God.
it's actually all the mucin that's collected inside, and it's just expanded and expanded and expanded, and then it makes what they call a jelly belly.
Incredible.
So yeah, Karen, who I met with, I was talking about in the last show, in part one, she was actually 10 years until they told her that they'd got pseudomyxoma.
My gosh.
She went for scans just thinking that she, you know, she's putting weight on, a bit bloating. And they said, if we don't operate within a few months, you're going to be dead.
My gosh.
But thankfully, I've never heard those words that, you know, you've
Exactly.
only got this amount of time.
Exactly.
I don't know how I would ever cope if I did hear those words, to be quite honest with you. But that's not something that I'm thinking about or thinking that's going to happen to me. So,
No,
yeah.
exactly. We're keeping it as positive as possible. And I mean, I see you. I can see you now. My listeners can't see you, but you are the most positive and vibrant person I've had the pleasure of meeting after having gone what you've gone through. It's quite incredible to see you look so well, actually. But I mean, that's a physical part. That's the outside part. But I mean, you are still healing in the inside. And I'm not even talking about the mental aspect of this disease.
Yeah, so obviously I woke up in the ICU and I needed the blood transfusion before they transferred me to the ward. And then I went on to the C2 ward, which is where everyone goes that has had this operation, where my days of recovery would begin. So I arrived on the C2 ward about 7:30 on the Friday evening. I wasn't allowed to have anything to eat for, I think, day three or day two. I was allowed to have a soup. No, day three, sorry, was a soup.
Oh
Up
my
until then,
goodness.
I was just on TPN. So they were
Oh.
feeding me through drips. And yeah, I just woke up and I just looked at, looked down the side of the bed, and I was like, what are all these lines like? I'm just attached. Like, my arms move and I've got lines and I've got wires. And she said that they're your chest drains and your abdominal drains, which I knew. Obviously, talking to survivors and Karen, I met Karen before going for MOAS, so obviously she gave me a lot of insight into the operation. So I didn't wake up like, oh my God, like what's happened to me? I kind of knew what I was about to expect. But I didn't quite realize the magnitude of the pain that I was going to endure. I know that people said it's not an easy recovery,
No.
and boy,
Yeah.
it when you live in it, you think, yeah, they say it's bad, but this is bad. So yeah, I had these I had two chest drains just below my under my armpit area. I had two in my just where my ribs were, and I had two near my pelvis. And they were just draining some of the heated chemotherapy out of me very slowly. So they don't like to just put the HIPEC in, rinse it out, and close you up. They'll
Okay.
close you up with the heated chemo still inside.
Wow. Oh my God.
Yeah, it's so
So
it's got that time to just slowly start killing off the cells in your body. So I mean, I was out of it for a good few days at least, really out of it. I had an epidural in my back, which they actually put into me when I was already under. Thank the Lord for that one. And yeah, I had an epidural in my back. I had stents in my back and my bowel. I had a catheter up my lady garden, chest drains, oxygen tube, NG tube up my nose, straight down into my stomach. I just felt like my body wasn't mine. But I was thankful that I was still alive. But I was in a bed, and you've got patients directly in front of you as well. So we're all in this just one sort of area. So I was in area one in the C2, which is near to the desk, because they like to put you there when you first come out of ICU. So you're basically monitored. And yeah, so day one, day two is very much a bit of a blur for me, to be honest. Day three, I believe they gave me a soup, which was spicy parsnip soup and a jelly. And I was like, because they brought me my lunch, and I was like, huh? Is this for me? Because like I and they're like, yeah. And I was like, but I can't eat. And they were like, you can start eating now. And I was like, oh, okay. And it actually felt nice to pick up a spoon and just feed myself a little bit of soup and eat a bit of jelly. And the days following were just a lot of it was a blur in the C2 ward, but one thing that does stick out is the gas pain. So I had my epidural taken out on day six. And when they'd taken that out, that's when I felt everything. Because prior to that, I was on morphine where I could administer it myself. So
Oh,
I'd
yes.
press like a PCA, they call it. So yeah, I was on that. So every time they wanted to change the sheets, they'd say, right, we need to roll you onto your side. So press the PCA to give you a boost, to obviously numb any pain. So I was constantly pressing that, but it recycles itself every 6 to 12 minutes. So
Yeah,
you can't
because
overdose on the
no.
morphine, basically. So I was on that, and that came off me on day seven, I believe, the day seven or eight, something like that. But once the epidural was out, that's when I felt everything.
Oh my God.
Everything, and I mean everything. I think the daytime I had a really good day, and then she asked me what I'd like for my dinner. And I was like, oh, I'll have mash with gravy, because it's very much soft food after this surgery, you know, like you're a baby. It's what it's like. People say it's like you're born again. And believe me, it felt like I was born again. I have to get to know my body. I have to get to know how it functions. I have to get to know certain foods that don't agree with me, make me sick. Thankfully, I wasn't sick in the whole of the time there, because they kept draining out my bile through the NG tube. So they'd plug in a little syringe to my NG tube and drain bile from my stomach that was collecting there, save me from vomiting. And I was just poked and prodded all the time that I lay in the ward. And then the staff would bed wash me. So a lot of it, you felt like I felt like I lost my dignity quite a lot as well. You know, lying in a bed and just getting, well, obviously I had no underwear on, because the type of surgery I had, you can't wear underpants for about a week. So I just lay in a gown, no underwear on, and yeah, being bed bath, just I felt like I was in a care home. You know, it was like I'm 39 years old, like I'm being bed bath. What the hell has my life come to? And yeah, it was just very hard to process everything that's gone on. So I had a really good day that day. I had my hair washed, not in a shower, because I could not stand at all till about, I think, day four, five. They got me out into a chair, but that was about as much as I could manage. And that was literally getting out of the bed to a chair right in front of the bed. And then gradually they'd move the chair a little bit further away when they got me out of bed in the days running after that. But so I ordered my dinner, and about 5 o'clock, Will was due to come, but he was stuck in so much bad traffic through Guildford. When he was on the way, I said, I've got horrendous gas pain kicking off. Can you please get me some polos? And they gave me peppermint water as well, a shot of peppermint water. But I kid you not, from 5:30 p.m. on that evening until 1 p.m. the following day, there was nothing that I could do. I was lying in agony.
Gosh.
And they said to me, we've given you ibuprofen, we've given you've got your PCA, we've given you peppermint water. I mean, I had about 12 cups of peppermint tea, 3 packs of polos. And yeah, all night I was crying out all night in pain. And other patients were next to me like that, or obviously a lot further along than I was. So I felt bad for them because I felt like I was disrupting everyone else. But I was like, I can't tolerate the pain. Like, I need to let this out. And it was trapped wind. And I'd not obviously passed any stool. So they just said to me, right, we're going to get you out of bed. You're just going to have to sit on the commode. And I was like, for how long? Because I can't sit up. I've got no energy. My core is just shot to pieces. And she said, till you can at least pass some wind or go to the toilet. And I just sat there, and just nothing was coming out at all till the following day. So yeah, every day in the ward was just soul destroying.
And you said the other woman in the ward, they had gone through the same type of surgery.
Yeah, but without obviously sounding rude, they were more sort of elderly than me. I was the youngest one laying in the bed on the C2 ward. A lady opposite me, she underwent the same operation, but sadly they couldn't get all of hers. But she was 78, and she'd survived this sort of surgery, which was remarkable in itself, really. But she just had the op just to give her more time.
Now, talking about PMP, what are actually the statistics? I mean, you are 39, and I mean, that's incredibly young for anyone to be diagnosed with cancer. Now, I've never heard of this cancer before, so what have you been able to gather? What are actually the statistics on age?
That the age, it doesn't matter. I know that Basingstoke have operated on someone as young as 21 years old. It is a 2 to 3 million, a 2 to 3 million per case, so it's very rare. So only 3 in a million will get this cancer per year,
My
and
God.
that's worldwide. That's not the UK. That is the cancer itself. Which my friends always said to me, like, if you were gonna get a cancer, trust you to get like the one that's like the rarest out there. But then on the flip side, it's good because even though it was obviously a cancer that I had, and it is cancer, it's not the worst one I could have been diagnosed with. So I have to kind of take something from it and sort of deem myself lucky in a way, I suppose.
And listening to in part one where you were sharing, the consultant that you met, the people that you met were all the right people at the right time. You were at the right hospital. You met even your going back to your GP who had the foresight to actually put you on a high alert so that this would go through very quickly. So you've had a lot of people that basically, well, they helped you in getting this sorted out as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I think the reason that I was rushed through so quickly as well is because my mother's history. Because they did, I mean, like Alex did say, obviously, like with your mother's history, and my GP did say, like, has anyone in your family had cancer of any sort? So from diagnosis from the beginning of August to MOAS on the 1st of November to being told I'm cancer free on the 2nd of November, it was very fast, which is why I think I've not had time to process it as much. Because I've just been catapulted from you have an ovarian cyst to no, you don't. You have like a cancer, and now you're going to have like the biggest operation that you can face in your life. So I was very much catapulted into a massive magnitude of a situation, really.
And I mean, not just you, but your partner as well.
So, he was always to and from Basingstoke when I was in there. He had to stay with me one night, actually. So if I just fast forward to day nine, they were the most horrific. Day nine was the most horrific day for me. I had chest drains removed previous to this, so I was only having, I think I had four drains left in at this point. But when they remove the chest drains, do they hurt? Yes, they do. And they tell you to breathe in, hold your breath, and you're just like, what the hell? I feel like you're ripping some wires and twisting in my body. And they tell you, oh, it's all right. It won't last a minute of pain, and then you'll be all right again. You've had another one out. But it's like, with all due respect, you're the nurses. You've not been on the operating table. Yes, you know what you're doing because you're the institute for this cancer, but you're caring for people that have been through it. You've not felt this impact on your body. So yeah, day nine was the worst. So they started me back on citalopram. Since 2012, I got anxiety because my dad got diagnosed with vascular dementia, Alzheimer's, and it was always a kind of a worry. He lived on his own. And they wanted to put me back on the citalopram. So I said, is this safe? That was my first question. Because the amount of drugs I have in my body, the morphine, fentanyl, ibuprofen, paracetamol, penicillin, I just thought this is a lot of drugs already in my body. Is it safe? And they were like, yeah, it's safe. We're going to start you back on your citalopram this morning. That was at 7 a.m. So I took the citalopram at 7 a.m. Everything was fine. I had lunch. And about 10 to 3, they wanted to move me out of the C2 ward area into my own little room. So basically, in Basingstoke, you'll come out of ICU, you'll go to C2, you'll be in the area with lots of other people in the bed. Not your bed, obviously, lots of other people in their beds. So they put me into room 12. And that I think that's a room that I'll never be able to even look at again without having a panic attack, to be honest. So I was in there about 3 o'clock. Started to feel funny, like I was having an out of body experience in a way, very bizarre. And I remember lying there, and my partner was here at the time. He'd come to see me, obviously, to get move my room. And I remember saying something like, "My feet are turning into paws." And I heard about these so-called hallucinations that people have had, but I was like day nine at this point, so I thought, "Oh, there's no hallucinations for me. I got rid of this." But then it got significantly worse for me because my mum appeared in the room. She was in the corner at the very top of the wall, and she was telling me that I had to go with her now. Yeah. So I was having shouting matches in the room with my mother, saying, "No, I've come this far. I'm staying with Will. I need to be here with Will and Neville. I'm going home. Shut up. You've not come to see me since you passed away. Why are you here now? Why are you doing this now?" And yeah, it was pretty traumatic that I felt that my mum was there because obviously she's passed away. So I kept saying to like the nurse, because I had like loads, so many nurses around the bed at this point, and even the psychology team were there. Yeah, I just said to them, I think I'm slipping away. I'm slipping away. And they were like, "Faye, we've got your obs on. Your heart rate's fine. Your blood pressure's fine." And yeah, it was very, very real. And then they give me the drug to calm me down. I fell asleep a little bit. And then I woke up again later on, about 6 o'clock in the evening, feeling very drowsy, and feeling weird again. So they actually got a psychology team to come all the way from London to Basingstoke, because the Basingstoke psychologist that I had, she hadn't really seen the extent of this before. Like she'd seen it, but obviously the worrying part was that I could see my mom. So yeah, they got the psychology team to come from London, and they just said, "Assessing you, we don't have any major concerns. We just think you've had a very bad reaction to something." And long story short, it turned out that the citalopram had reacted with the fentanyl, and on top of that, I also had a urine infection, which also reacted. I don't know how a urine infection can make you hallucinate, but
No.
it was all of those three things that had come together.
Together.
So they asked my partner if he could stay the night. I said to them, "I can't stay in this room. I can't sleep in this room." So they asked someone if they'd be happy to swap rooms with me. A lady was in room 4. I was in 12, just to get me out, because I said, I can't be in this room tonight. I cannot be in this room tonight. If you tell me I've got to be in this room tonight, I will discharge myself and I'll go home. And it was so scary, just the thought of being in that room all night, knowing that my mom had like visited in there. I just felt like I had to escape from that room. And I went into room 4, which is a lot bigger, a lot more bright colored wall. And yeah, they gave Willa a bed. And he didn't even sleep, bless him. He just literally stayed awake all night reading books, keeping an eye on me,
Watching over you.
watching me, yeah.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick commercial break and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Stoma for Life. Now, we were chatting about the unsung heroes, the caregivers that are watching over us once we've been presented with our own diagnosis. And Faye was mentioning how her partner was actually allowed to stay with her for one night after you've had this really terrible reaction towards it was basically a cocktail of different medicines.
Yeah, and then obviously, like, I got discharged on day 11, so we'll fast forward a little bit. Otherwise, we're going to be in a three-parter here. So obviously, I've had the hallucinations, the drains have come out, and my obs were all fine, everything like that. So my question was, the beds were getting very uncomfortable. I wasn't sleeping very well at all, and they always said to me, "We know when people are ready to go home when they start moaning about the bed." So my question to the consultant was, I need to be at home after all the hallucinations and all the trauma and everything. I was very on edge.
Because, I mean, let's face it, a hospital, I mean, there is so much activity going on in a hospital. I mean, I don't know what it was like with you, but I could hardly get any sleep. I had to take my sleeping mask with me. I had my earplugs with me because it is so noisy there. The lights are forever on. Everybody's walking in and out.
So yeah, same thing for me. Eye mask, earbuds, blankets. It was just so uncomfortable in the end, and I just said I just want to go home. So on the Saturday, he basically just said, "I don't see why we're keeping you in here." And he was like, "Let's get you home then, shall we?" And I was crying. I was like, "What? Really? I can go home, really? You're not like, when? Like, you're not." He said, "Today." He said, "I'll get it all drawn up. We get your medication sorted." And I said, "What time?" Because my partner was going to bring the dog, obviously, later on as planned. So what time can he pick me up? And he said, after 1 o'clock, when the medicines have all been dispatched and everything, dispensed, sorry, not dispatched. See, I'm in bloody aviation mode. Dispense. Yeah, you can go home. I remember the car journey on the way home, I cried. It felt very surreal being wheeled out of Basingstoke because I arrived there with cancer and I was going home without cancer.
You left a huge part behind there.
Yeah, it was very, very surreal. In the car, I cried. Like, am I actually like, is it happening? Am I going home? But I was also scared because the magnitude of the surgery I'd had, I kind of felt like, oh my God, now I'm on my own. You know, what if something was to go wrong with like anything internal, hernias or blood clots or anything like that? And you know, the famous blood thinner needles that you have to have. I had 35 days of those. So that wasn't great every day having sticking needles in me. But thankfully, my partner was brave because he hates needles. He came through for me and injected me every single evening. I'm very thankful and very lucky that I have the support network that I've had through the whole of this, actually, because, you know, he's made my drinks. He's got my hot water bottles. He's got my medication. He's helped me get out of bed in the first few days home because I just couldn't move out the bed. Trying to sit up was just horrendous, painful. And I actually mistakenly got sent home with no painkiller in the bag. So I was told just take paracetamol, which was a bit weird for me because after the laparotomy, I was on dihydrocodeine and paracetamol. Yet after such a magnitude of a surgery I'd had, they told me just take paracetamol every 4 hours, which they've actually, when I had my follow-up a few weeks ago, they did actually, he did actually apologize that that mistake had been made. I was home on the Saturday evening and I was okay till I went to bed, and I was in agony all night and Sunday.
Oh dear.
So my partner had to go back to Basingstoke, bless him, after thinking we've escaped the place, to go and pick up Oramorph. And I
Okay.
was on Oramorph 4 times a day, 10 mils of Oramorph 4 times a day. And to be honest, that made me feel like an absolute zombie. They say that obviously, you want the medicine to take away the pain, but it's like how do they describe it? When you've got like two things that, yeah, it cancels out the pain, but it does something else. So yes, it made the pain go away, but it made me feel horrendous in myself. And it was only when I fast forwarded and came off the morphine that I started to feel normal, new normal, that I could function a little bit more better. And fast forward to where I am now, I'm just starting on my physio. But it's been a hell of a journey with the food side as well. I started on minimal portions of food. And for me, I'm a massive foodie. Like I love my food. Like, so to be told that you can only have one roast potato, a little bit of chicken with gravy on top, and that's it.
Did you
Well,
get any dietary advice in hospital already, or is this knowledge that you've accumulated?
so this is actually knowledge that I've accumulated from support groups through Facebook and online. Unfortunately, when I got discharged, the dietitian was not working because it was a weekend. All I got told is I need to go on a bland diet. So a lot of it was guesswork for about a month with food, which was very, very frustrating because I was actually scared to eat. What if I eat that and I get horrendous pain? So I don't want to eat because I don't want the pain. It was actually turned out it was the morphine that was giving me the severe stomach ache that I was having, which is why they put me off it and well, weaned me off it as such. But when I did come off it completely, I had the withdrawal, the usual withdrawal. And on top of that, I'm having to deal with the menopause. Obviously
So,
being forced into that with this sweating, shaking, anxiety, feeling on edge, just nervous. I've literally had a fan on me since I got home on the 11th of November. I've slept with a fan on me every night in the bedroom. Even now, I still have it through winter.
Obviously, you've been basically, well, you basically fell into menopause straight away. And are you on HRT, hormone replacement?
Am, yeah. So they've started me on Everol 50 in Basingstoke, and I continued on that when I came out until about a few weeks ago, where I've now had to up to Everol 75, purely because what they think is I've gone from obviously being 39, maximum estrogen in my body, to nothing.
From one
So,
day to the next, obviously.
yeah, so I was experiencing very severe headaches with Everol 50, migraines, fatigue, just the whole shebang, really, which is why they've now upped me to 75. And thankfully, I can say that the headaches have dispersed quite a lot. I still get the odd one, don't get me wrong, a little bit of a migraine, but they're not as frequent as they was, and the fatigue has eased off significantly as well. So yeah, dealing with the menopause as well as dealing with recovering from MOAS is it's just been a massive roller coaster of everything.
Yeah. Just listening to your story is a roller coaster in itself. I'm a very visual person, so I don't just listen. I've got the pictures in my mind as well, you know.
Feel like
So
you're on a day out in Thorpe Park, probably.
So
Yeah, it's so what was your I was going back to the food side of things. I was very
yeah,
scared to
please.
eat. So yeah, I just started with jelly ice cream. Partner got me a lot of Müller corners with a strawberry compote, natural yogurt. It's just things like that. And then you gradually try and increase. So you'll go from one roast potato to two. Stay away from greens. If you've had this magnitude of surgery, MOAS, any sort of bowel surgery, actually, I believe, you stay away from greens. Anything that can cause you gas is not going to end well, basically. And so I took the advice. I didn't risk it purely because I was told that some patients have gone home and they've had sprouts at Christmas or broccoli and they've been in the fetal position on the floor in agony. And it causes bowel blockages also, which would result going back to the hospital and returning to theatre. So I had all these scary thoughts like, what if I eat that and I get a bowel blockage? I don't want to go back to an operating table, do you know? So
No.
you're constantly battling with food to begin with. And I think when I came off the Oramorph, I think probably week 7 post-op is when my food intake started to be a bit better. So yeah, I was able to reintroduce things like carrots, peas. I did have stuffing on week four, a little tiny teaspoon. I tell you, it was literally minimal, and I was in agony for 3 days
Oh dear.
because the onion as well can really cause problems. Anything acidic, really. Tomatoes, onion, salad. So yeah, it was very, very confusing. So I basically lived on rice, roast potatoes, homemade ones, may I add. They're delicious. He makes the best roast potatoes, my partner. I was craving roast potatoes all the time. Yogurts, jelly, noodles, Maggie's super noodle things, instant noodles. No crisps because they're quite rough for the inside of the surgery I'd had done. I didn't want to eat crisps. Crumpets, I went on to crumpets. Toast with a little bit of marmalade, but none with the peel in, because you have to avoid seeds, you have to avoid nuts, you have to avoid peel, anything with skin, you have to avoid. So yeah, it's been a massive shake-up on my diet as well. But thankfully, where I'm at now, I'm back to eating full portions. roast dinners, yay! Spaghetti bolognese. Yeah, it's great for me now with the food side. I've really battled through many nights of pain in the beginning, but I'm out the other side with the food. So now it's just the physio side that's really grabbing me at the moment.
But isn't it incredible? Those things we all take for granted. Just sitting down and having a meal. I mean, we take it for granted. And those are milestones for you.
They are. And when I put on my Instagram stories, like, I've done like 4 minutes on the bike. This is a massive win. I know some people are thinking, like, 4 minutes, that's nothing. But for me, it's huge because of what I've gone through. And I think it's important, as a lot of hindsight comes in once you're out the other side. Like, I kept a food diary. That's one thing I will say for listeners to do, is keep a food diary. So jot down what foods you've been able to tolerate. I had a lot of Dairy Lee with Ritz crackers, not cream crackers, because they're very dry and the digestion is not great with them, as I found out myself. So I just had like the Ritz, little tiny circle Ritz crackers, and just spread Dairy Lee on top of them. Most of my lunches was that, some snacks. As your body is repairing, you will just want to keep snacking, which is great for me. I don't mind, and Alex at Basingstoke did say snacking is great for the first 3 months. Just keep snacking, crisps, chocolate, cakes, things with sugar. You need things with sugar, energy, because that's what your body needs. So a lot of the food you eat in the beginning, you've suffered with the fatigue, and mine was really bad. Because your body is taking all of the energy from the food for itself, and it's not for you.
No.
So once your body's absorbed all the energy it needs to repair, then the food you'll start to take, that will then be for you. Finding now, like, I can walk, get myself a drink from the fridge. I've not been able to cook a meal yet. I've not been able to stand long enough to have, to do cooking, but it is something that I'd like to do, because my partner has been literally doing everything for me since I got out of hospital. And like you said, they get very overlooked. So I'd love to just be able to say, have a night off, I'm going to cook a meal. I have been buying him beers though, and takeaways, treating him to Domino's, his favorite. So I do appreciate everything he does, and I do try and show it in some way. Because without him, I know it sounds dramatic, but I think without him, I probably would have just ended this when I got out of hospital. Because there was a point where I was in so much pain, so thin. You look at yourself in the mirror and you're so thin and there's nothing to you and you're in pain. And it does cross your mind, like, I haven't got a life at the minute. And am I going to get my life back? Because I don't know what the future holds. And I'm very lucky. And some listeners will probably think, you're not cancer anymore. Some people don't make it. And it is sad. Some people don't make it. But the reason I'm sorry to share my story is not for a sympathy thing. It's more to give you the reality of what this actually is and what it does to you. The whole aspect is why I've documented every single thing. I've gone on my stories crying. I've gone on my stories looking absolutely horrendous. But like I said to people, cancer's not pretty.
No,
You
and
know,
it's
I'm not in a photo studio anymore. I'm not the model Faye. This is me. I've had cancer and I've come out the biggest operation that you can have. So I'm showing you the reality of this. I'm not here to get hearts and likes like I'm a modeling pictures.
No.
You know, I'm not here for that. I'm here to show you me, and I've opened myself and I've been vulnerable with it all, and I still am to this day. Like,
Of course.
but milestones are going out in my car, being able to drive again, going
Yes.
out for lunch, going outside. It's all these little wins, and I celebrate every single one, because when I first got diagnosed, I didn't think that I'd ever see the sky again, or that you just look at things very differently. Like a tree
Absolutely.
is not just a tree.
No.
Like, you appreciate it blows in the wind and its beauty, and you just appreciate everything that's around you.
Yeah, absolutely. And you said in part one, you said you were thinking of funeral arrangements. You've come from a very dark place because nobody, I don't think anybody can relate to this, unless you've gone through something like that, what it does to you. And then to now see you the way you are now, you said it's like a child having to learn everything from new, and you're also rediscovering everything again. You're seeing it with total different eyes.
Yeah, and a lot of people have said to me, like, your mom's been looking down on you through the whole of this. She was the one that guided you to the cyst. You've got a
Absolutely.
guardian angel. And I've always thought to myself, do you know what? My mum couldn't finish off cancer, but I'm going to. And that's the mentality I went into the operating theatre with. Like, you finished off my mum, but you ain't finishing me off.
Yeah. Oh, that's
You know?
such a positive attitude and such an important attitude to have. We're going to take a quick commercial break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Stoma for Life. I've got Faye here, part two of her story being diagnosed with PMP. Now, Faye, this is getting really personal now, but I know you've had chemotherapy because just the way you explained this, what was it called? A hot pack?
IPEC, yeah.
I mean, and I associate chemo with hair loss,
Yeah,
but
and that is a lot,
you
a
don't
lot.
have any hair loss.
No, so I've had that question a lot on my socials, like, because I had long hair, and people are like, did you have it trimmed because you lost it from chemo or anything? And I was like, no, I had a different haircut, because when I look at photos now, I look at them and think, right, that's when I had cancer. Like, so I'll have a Facebook memory where I was in Dubai or on holiday, and I look at that picture and I'm like, how the hell was cancer there all along with us on holiday? A lot of the photos I feel tarnished, you know? And I just thought, I've not got cancer now. I'm gonna chop my hair off. I'm gonna have a different image, you know, have a different hairstyle. This is me reinventing myself. There's nothing to do with the chemotherapy. So the chemotherapy that I actually had is, it's put into the abdomen. So it's like, it's a heated wash, and because it's not systemic, it doesn't cause any hair loss. It doesn't cause you to lose your eyebrows, your hair, or anything like that. It's not like the chemotherapy that you would know for other cancer. But obviously, it's about educating people as well, really, I think. Where, I mean, my mom had proper chemo. She did have a little bit of hair loss and her eyebrows, and she was in pain with it in bed. You know, it really made her blood cell count very low. She had a lot of blood transfusions because the chemo ruined a lot of her platelets were always low. But no, the type of chemo I had was just into my abdomen, and it wasn't systemic. So thankfully, it didn't do anything to me that has made me lose my hair.
Now, we were talking, or I was talking about that you're raising awareness, and you yourself have spoken about awareness. I mean, just picture that going into a or being advised by the Macmillan cancer nurse and being sent home with a total different pamphlet of cancer for your own diagnosis. I mean, there was nothing you said on PMP. So how are you going to proceed? How are you going to go about raising awareness on this type of cancer?
So obviously, a lot of my media went global,
Yeah.
which has been absolutely fantastic. I joined a UK press agency that scouted me on Instagram after my diagnosis and said we'd like to like, you've got this rare cancer diagnosis, we'd like to do a story. And I said to them, there's no story at the moment. I'm due to have mother of all surgery in November. If you're happy to wait, then we can pick up after I've recovered from that. Because for me, there isn't a story to tell. What am I going to tell you? I've been diagnosed with rare cancer. I'm about to go for an operation. End of it. I wanted to share the whole experience with people. So they were like, yeah, they were fine. She wasn't very pushy. The journalist, she just said, yeah, we'll wait and we wish you the best and let us know when you're ready to pick up. And I worked with Jam Press, and yeah, it was the Daily Mail bidded for the exclusive. So they had the exclusive story to start with. And then it went to the Metro, the Sun, the Mirror. And then all of a sudden, the next thing I know, I'm around the world. I've got people following me saying, I've seen your story in Croatia. And I was like, huh? So now I'm Googling like Faeces, PMP or pseudomyxoma. And then this whole thing is just coming up. Like, I went across Hungary, Germany, Croatia, America, Washington, New York, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, even North Korea.
My
You
gosh.
know, and it's fantastic because A, it lets the general public know that it's out there, but also medical professionals can learn from it as well and hopefully just diagnose people that little bit quicker rather than trying to fob you off with, oh, you might have constipation, you might have period pain, take this, do a test, do a scan, and if you feel that something's wrong with your body, go to the GP. Yes, it might be nothing, but it might be something, as I've discovered. So don't be scared to ask for these scans and tests and push it, because going back to my mom, she got diagnosed with IBS for 2 years. They kept saying to her, it's just IBS, it's just IBS, take these tablets, IBS, and it got worse and worse for her. Then they sent her for a colonoscopy, and that's when they discovered, ah, you've got bowel cancer. All I can say to listeners and people on my socials is don't be ashamed to go and get a scan. Don't be ashamed to go and get a test. You're well within your rights to ask for it if you feel something's not right, because you're the only one that knows your body.
And nobody fights for your life like yourself.
Oh, I know that, yeah.
Absolutely. So, Faye, we've sadly come to the end of this show. I mean, it's been absolutely a roller coaster ride for me just listening to your story, but I am so thankful for you to have been able to share the story and for what you do to educate the people out there, because I certainly have learned so much listening to you. I wish you all the best going forward now. I mean, it's only been 3 months.
Thank you for joining me on the awareness train. Can I quickly say I'm also running for Race for Life in Brighton, 6 months after major surgery. That's my target, to raise money for cancer research. So I'm also doing that.
That's a 10 kilometer run, is that correct?
Yes. No, I'm doing the 10K around Brighton in June, end of June, yeah, for cancer research.
Oh my, yeah, I'm holding thumbs. I'm going to be cheering from the sideline.
Yeah,
Okay,
come down, come along.
it's been absolutely wonderful speaking with you, Faye. All
Thank you.
the very best. Take care. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye.